Hey everyone, welcome back to Seeking What They Sought. I'm Sean Lenhoff. I'm here with Anthony Leiter and our guest today, which is Dr. Greg Howell. Wanted to make
Doctor.
Matthew paid
thank
me.
Thank you.
Matthew Lucio paid me some good money to make sure I didn't forget to say Dr. Greg Howell. And if you're wondering why I'm mentioning Matthew Lucio, it's because Greg actually works with him. He's one of our fellow podcasters. He's on Adventist Pilgrimage. And that's a part of the Adventist podcast or the, the Adventist History Project, right? That's the official umbrella term, right?
Yeah, that's the umbrella, yeah.
Yeah. So there's multiple podcasts that are part of Adventist History. And one of them is the one that you're part of, Greg. And you've got your colleague as well.
Michael Campbell,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Michael Campbell. And so we're just excited to have you on and speak with you a little bit. So
thanks for having me.
Yeah,
guys.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks. I've been a long time listener.
Wow.
Yeah. And actually, Greg, you go back with us. So the three of us, the thing that we have in common beyond just Adventist podcasting is that we all decades ago were in the Washington Conference in Washington State. And we're all pretty close together. In fact, where I met you was as probably a 10 to 12 year old. I don't remember what age I was, but you
somewhere in there.
Yeah, you were at my dad's church, Auburn City. And that was back in the early 2000s. This is what's weird for me is you're the second former youth pastor to work with my dad on this podcast. We had Matthew Gamble on.
I heard that one.
Who was on a few years before you at Auburn City. So anyways, we go ways back, Greg. I remember you and your wife and just distant memories from that. And I know that you worked with Anthony and others at the Auburn camp meeting, one of the biggest.
Yeah, you worked with my dad as well at Auburn camp.
I did. Right? I had a couple of years. I think he was in the early teen tent and we worked together a couple of years on that one. And then I was over, they put me leading out in the primary tent, which I to say was actually awesome because primary age kids, they're fantastic. They don't need to be taken to the bathroom, but they are totally like still engaged in every single thing in your program.
Stoked.
They love it.
They don't like hate you and everything yet.
Yeah, no. That early teenage is where like all of a sudden you are the least cool thing. And So I loved primary.
Oh yeah.
Good years.
Nice. And then am I making this up? I have memories of you at summer camp being a camp pastor. Is that real? Did I make that up?
No, I did do that one summer which
was
one
Sunset
was that?
Or Big Lake?
It was
Lake
Sunset.
Or...
No, it wasn't Big Lake, it was Sunset. And I don't remember if it was like a teen or if it was a tween. It was one of those. But I did do that one week. Yeah.
Okay.
I was so close I could just drive up. So I actually didn't even have to stay there.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So, yeah.
Nice. A little insider knowledge there.
All kinds of stuff.
Sunset Lake, man. Dude, we could talk about Sunset Lake for a while.
You're really good.
Actually, Anthony, we should at some point talk about
Avenue
Summer
Camp. Actually.
That is such a big part of... How have we not talked about that?
We need to, you know who we need to have on the podcast? Sorry, Greg, but him. We should have Dave Yeagley on the podcast and talk to him about
the stories. The stories.
Why have we not? That's insane.
You could have Yeagley. You could have Heinrich. You could have. You could have a couple of really fun ones on. You know, I listened to a great podcast episode on This American Life talking about people who work at summer camp because it's like a unique breed of people. They had like a whole arc. And I was thinking, like, Adventist summer camps, we could totally do this.
Yep.
Oh, man. Okay, I'm adding this to our master list right now.
Yeah, 2025. That's
ways to make money in college and Adventism, man.
Oh, yeah, it's real. Ways to make, like, a tiny bit of money.
Get that matching made you feel good.
It's all about the match. That's right.
It's all about the match. That's right.
Yeah. It makes it feel like it's more. Instead of $2, you get $4 towards your
I still remember my first summer of camp, and I realized how much we were making, and I was, like, counting the hours, and I was like... We're here for the love.
The
love
the
of the game.
Sweatshop. It's Avenue Sweatshop.
I counted hours as a pastor one time, and it was not fun. I didn't like thinking about that.
I believe it.
Or not teaching. Great. So help me.
Oh yeah, all of it.
Speaking of Avenue education,
perfect segue.
Yes, Greg, you have an extensive background in both pastoral ministry and in education, and this is one of the reasons we wanted to have a conversation with you. Is we've talked with a few people about there being a bit of a divide between pastors and teachers within the Adventist Church. We've kind of said it in passing, maybe a little bit of a focused, if brief, conversation with Larry Blackmer, the former VP for the NAD for Education. But you are someone that has lived it to a very personal level. And I wanted to talk with you about your experience in that. Because it's one thing to hear it and hear there's a divide, and this is with any topic, right? We can all talk about political, racial divides, religious divide, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But if you've lived it, if you've actually been in that culture, been in that battle, you have a unique perspective to share.
Yeah, yeah.
And so just a quick background again, we mentioned you're a doctor, but mm-hmm. that's a pretty new experience for you, right? You've
very new.
It's been the last 3 or so years that you've been at the collegiate level as a professor.
Yeah.
But you've spent most of your time, I have here that you were a pastor for 14 years.
Yeah. All those years in Washington, pretty much, yeah.
And then teaching for 8.
Yeah, the last 8. So okay. That's the most recent thing I've done.
So was that order? You did 14 years of pastor, you did 8 years of teaching, and then it's kind of transitioned where you've done both collegiate and the high school level? Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's been one of those journeys, like coming straight out of undergrad. I got picked up by Washington, pastored up there, went to seminary with them for about 14 years total with all of that. Had 9 different churches over the years.
Wow.
You know, the last couple churches were districts, so those, you know, are kind of double. But 9 total, you know, I kind of still look at them as individual churches because they're all have their own personalities and their own quirk. And then after that, I've been at one school here in Northern California. We took a call from my wife. She's the associate pastor at Carmichael. And she's been the family life pastor there for about 10 years going on now. And so there was a little gap couple of years there between pastoring full time for me and then getting into the teaching gig. You know, a couple of people moved, a couple of people dropped off the thing. So they needed somebody to fill unique teaching slots. And I got lucky to be around and I was able to kind of squeeze in. So I've never taken an education class. You know, I wasn't an education minor or anything like that. So I felt kind of lucky to even have squeaked my way into education, honestly. Mm. So
can you tell us a little, and I don't know, maybe Sean, you were going to start here anyway, but can you tell us a little about like, what was the initial... I love hearing about like the initial heart for being a pastor and then how that shifted over the years to then switch to teaching.
Yeah. You know, I can honestly say I was in high school. My mind was geared towards technology and computers. And I thought I was going to be like, you know, a graphic designer or work with special effects in the movies or something cool like that. Right. I had a nerdy side of me that was clearly on the verge of too nerdy, but not quite. You know, I still had some awareness of my nerdiness. And then I felt the call to ministry. I actually had a real personal conversion experience. I'd been Adventist my whole life, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's yours until you really experience it for yourself. So I did some prayer conferences in high school, my junior year in high school, kind of got into some leadership stuff at a student level, and then went into theology and computer science both when I went to Union. Mm-hmm. So kind of had a chance to live a little bit in two worlds because I wasn't totally sure the pastoring thing was mine. And then I got an internship up at North Cascade, actually, when Dave Wagley was president of Washington Conference. And I was up there for a year working with Gary Fogelquist, pastor up there, who was fantastic as a mentor.
Sure.
Gary.
Fantastic guy. Really gave me 12 months of pastoral experience that kind of solidified my passion and my drive to serve the church in a pastoral role. He made it fun, honestly. He showed me that it mattered, that it was valuable, that you could have an impact, and that it was worth putting all of my eggs in that basket. So, you know, I finished out Union with a theology degree. I wrapped up and got like an associate's in computer networking and stuff, and then springboarded straight off into pastoring. So that's when I met you guys. My first church was there at Auburn City back in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
So worked with Sean's dad.
Yeah.
Nice.
Good couple of years.
Yeah. Well, so Greg, I'm curious, before you started teaching, so you went through 14 total years before you even touched being a teacher. Is that right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Did you have a perspective on Adventist education as a pastor in those early 2000s that maybe is different from what you would see today, just being a pastor?
Yeah. I think I did, in the sense that my first real pastoring experience up in North Cascade was with a church that was very much connected to its Bible school right across the street. It was a K to 10, and they were going real strong, and there was just a very much a supportive environment for Adventist education and the church setting. So it very much felt like the school was just an extension of church. Like, we just did it all together. Yeah. So there was a lot of positive back and forth with that. I'm a product of Adventist education. I went from first grade all the way up through, you know, master's level. So I feel like I've seen it as a student. I see the value in it. I put my own kids through it. And there's definitely a sense as a pastor looking at it all of a sudden where I was like, I'm a product of this system and I feel committed to it. And yet I know, I also know that, there's always stuff and it's always hard. My little district, it's funny. I started in North Cascade. And then when I left Washington Conference, the North Cascade area was my last church too. I was just the church right across the river in Mount Vernon. So I kind of ended in the same place. I was on the school board, you know, at the same church that I'd kind of started at years before. And it was interesting because as a pastor, your churches are never the same. North Cascade was still the dominant church and Mount Vernon was smaller, but constituent still. But we weren't able, you know, necessarily to support the church as much as we wanted because we didn't have as many people. We didn't have as much tithe money and all that kind of stuff. So it's always interesting. As a pastor, you're on the boards, you're on the finance committees. You know the teachers and the people as people, but then you're also like part of the decision-making process that kind of governs the teacher life. And it's a sticky spot to be in. You want to be pastoral, and yet you also have to make those decisions that are not always popular or easy. So yeah, it's a unique perspective.
Yeah, Anthony, go ahead. Go for it.
Oh, I was just going to say that's super real. And first of all, my first thought was that, so my first church was up in Fidalgo Island on Anacortes.
Oh, yeah. Anacortes,
so
yeah.
I got to go over to...
you had a lot of my people.
Yeah, I did. A lot of the Mount Vernon people that had been
went
in Mount Vernon
to Anacortes,
during
yep.
your era ended up there.
Right before me. It kind of, that move happened right before I got there, yeah.
Okay, nice. So we probably know a lot of the same people.
Beautiful. I'm sure we do, yeah.
I love it.
Good folk. I love that whole northwest part of Washington State.
It's beautiful.
I miss the people. I don't miss the weather. I'll leave it at that.
That's fair.
Yeah. We are currently like at upper 60s, mid 70s all throughout winter here in
LA. I miss
the
gray. So. I miss the rain, honestly.
Wow. Yeah.
I do. It's weird. I didn't have seasonal affective at all. So and I also didn't have crow's feet until I moved to California because I never squinted. Oh, okay. There was never sun to make me squint.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's real.
So, so you have a very positive outlook, and even during your pastoral time, you talk about being a product of Adventist education. You feel like you had an overall positive experience viewing Adventist education, even during your pastoral years. Many people would say that being a pastor, you're on the other side, and that's a very, you know, superficial way of putting it, because obviously, like you described, so many Adventist churches have, by design, a very tight knit community that is interlocked with an Adventist school.
Yeah.
Especially if it's like a small church in a small school.
Yeah.
Or if it's on the same campus, right? Whether it's a small school or say like Auburn
or
Adventist
Academy. Church,
it's on the same campus. So it all just feels like one community, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what Anthony and I grew up with at Auburn Academy. But for many people, again, there's an experience of education being this other, you know, group. And this other side, and then on the flip side, that's sometimes how education, the teachers, and those administration will view the church and the pastoral team and those involved there. Did you firsthand experience that ever in a very dramatic way or in a very difficult way? Like, do you have any experience or stories that involve, like, what's an example of where you saw that firsthand?
I had a church. Out of the 9 churches, I would say three of them had a school directly connected with it. 4, if you count a church that had the school but had to shut it down, and they were always pining to get it back. So that was like always their mission of, we must open the school again. And I get there and I'm like, guys, we have zero way of doing that. Like, I'm sorry, that was so awesome for you, but there's no way. So, I mean, I remember those kind of things. But the worst... Let's say the most intimate look at the dysfunction and the pain that can be caused between the two entities did show up in one of my churches, because it was a small one-room school. We'd had maybe 15 kids, you know, the year I first got there in a first grade through eighth grade setting. So we were hiring one teacher, and, you know, that person's doing all of the grades and principaling and everything. You know, I mean, it's like you're the one job. the church is funding that largely because tuition's not going to do it all. They're not going to be able to pay even half of the teacher's salary at that rate with the tuition. So the church is putting in $35,000 a year. And then the next year I'm there, the student comeback rate was going to be about seven kids that were dropping off. And then we made it through one more year. Again, the church heavily subsidizing the school to keep it going. One of the teachers left, went on maternity leave, and then we were hunting around and found another teacher very close to the beginning of the year. Got them all out there. Everything was seeming okay. And then about halfway through the year, the church decided, you know, it's right when people are like signing up for the next year. We were only going to have three. And that's the returning number. And so I'm looking at the numbers. We're all looking at the numbers, the church, the school, everybody. There is no school board. It's just the church board, you know? And so everybody's looking and realizing, well, we can throw another 30, 40 grand into this thing and keep watching it sink. Or we can just call it now. And what's unfortunate is seeing what had to happen with the discussion, but also seeing the teacher who is now suddenly stranded mid-year because they closed it down at semester. In the winter there. And so it's impossible for him to go anywhere else because everything's already happening. You know, nobody else is really looking for anything. He's not in a position where he can support himself. His wife wasn't working. There was a lot of, there was a spiral of depression that hit really hard on that teacher. He started not being able to make, you know, rent payments, which also was had been given to him by the school. And so, you know, the, everything got messy, and real hard. And I worked with him personally. I worked with the board personally, and there was always the personality back and forth between, is this a money issue? Is this a people issue? Are we here to support our teacher? Are we here to support our school? Are we going to make a financially good choice, or are we going to keep somebody afloat who's going to fall apart and be homeless? Like those were the choices that we're staring at. Right. And I wasn't going to win with anybody. I'm chairing all these meetings and committees that are making all these hard choices. Nobody's going to like anything that is coming out of these. I put off, you know, telling the guy he had to move because he hadn't paid rent for 6 months or something. And at the same time, you know, the board is getting upset. Why aren't we doing anything about this? We can evict and I'm going, this is not awesome. So being That's part hard. Of a school shutdown. And then being part of the aftermath of a teacher whose life just fell apart and has no life raft, except us who did it to him. That is tricky. And there is no easy solutions in those moments because you're just there making the financial call, but you're also personnel and HR for this guy and everything else in between.
So it's a bit of a lose-lose.
It is. And it was probably the hardest education and church situation I ever had to go back and forth between. Really tough.
That's ultimately what the most of the conflict surrounds is economics. It's the finances of what to do. It seems to be the biggest challenge. There's other sub challenges within there, like what is the mission of the school? What is, you know, the way that church and school are supposed to work together when it comes to total quality time spent at either campus, right? Like, are the pastors spending enough time on the school campus? Are the teachers spending enough quality time in the sanctuary, in the programs of the church? But ultimately, that is a sub, you know, conflict with the bigger one, which is we're spending money on this. So what is our return from this investment? And what do we argue is supposed to be the return? What do we supposed to be looking for, right?
Well, and even beyond ROI, you're looking at, is this fulfilling the mission of the church in the moment where we currently are? It did. You know, it used to be the thing that really did make a name for us in the community. It really did fulfill a need with people who didn't have other Christian schools to send their kids to. But that's not the case anymore. And so you're looking at it not even just financially, but missionally and saying, well, this isn't really what the community needs from us anymore.
Did you ever feel like you answered that question between, you mentioned sort of weighing between, hey, I'm this man's pastor. I'm here for pastoral care. I'm here to be there for him as a human in the world. But then also I'm like his boss and like, I'm like, you know, I'm sharing this with these boards that deciding his career fate and whether or not he gets evicted. Did you ever feel like you came to a conclusion on which took priority, or was that always just attention?
It was always attention. I mean, I helped him. I pushed the board to help him and support him financially at the end, to the point where it was damaging my own relationship with the board. And I was fighting that fight on one side, saying we gotta help this guy. He's got nowhere. He's got nothing. And then on his side, I'm also walking in his door and saying, I'm gonna help you pack up your stuff today, because next week the sheriff's gonna be here if we don't do something.
Yeah.
So I have to get you moved into a storage unit over on this side of town. And wow. that tension was never Ooh. Gone. It was never gone. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Like I said, that was probably the worst confluence of education and church that I had to go through, from wow. my experience at least.
Are you comfortable sharing like how that ended for him?
Yeah. So I think, and I'm sure the people that know and are listening would know what I'm talking about. As far as I know, the ending for it was the church bought him an RV, and tried to set him up in that and put his stuff into a storage unit, and they paid for like the first, I don't know, 3 months of it or something for him. And then just kind of said, we got to cut the line here. This is as much yeah. as we can do for you. I mm-hmm. want to say that he didn't get back into teaching. He was trying to get a job at Walmart. You know, he was trying to do just odd jobs. He eventually got, I think the RV broke down. He couldn't afford to fix it. He couldn't pay for the storage unit, so they auctioned off all his stuff. I mean, that Ooh. Happened after I was gone, I think, was because I left probably 6 months later or so. So I think those kind of things definitely left a pretty bitter taste, because I heard from other churches where he was at that we had done him pretty darn wrong, according to how the churches were feeling about it. So I knew from the grapevine of reputation that came back, it was a smear. But at the same time, I understood where he was coming from. And then I also understood where we were coming from. Like, it was like I said, the hardest point to be in, but I don't think I ever fully threaded the needle well.
Yeah.
There was no well.
Yeah. Yeah. Impossible situation.
Yeah.
That is kind of the double-edged sword of Adventism, is you have a close-knit community, but as you said, the grapevine, there is this sense of like,
ain't that the truth?
If something happens, like that will get communicated very quickly, whether it's a school shutting down, a professional, whether it's a pastor, a teacher, or administrator getting let go or something else.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it can, you know, that rumor mill just catches on fire with an Adventism.
Yeah.
And we've all experienced that firsthand. We've seen plenty outside of our situation. Say,
you guys
well.
Have seen your dads, like it's all there.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Some of us have been part of the rumor mill, like having been a pastor who got divorced while pastoring.
Yeah.
It's a real thing.
It is. It is.
Yeah. So after transitioning to being a teacher, is there any component of, you know, a piece of your perspective that has changed when it comes to how you view the role of Adventist education? You actually made the claim, which I found interesting, Greg, that Adventist education doesn't fit that same role that it used to for the community.
True. You said that a minute ago.
So I'm curious. I want to go back. I want to circle back to that and ask you, do you think that Adventist education does play a role, a vital role in our community? Should it still be around?
Yeah, great question. Contextually, as I was saying that, I was thinking we couldn't compete with the two other Christian schools that cropped up in that little town. And so our little one-room school was not going to be the one that local Christian families wanted to send their kids to. And our demographic in the church was so old that they didn't have kids to send to it to support anymore. So it wasn't what I felt the church's mission was in that community anymore, because we couldn't compete and we didn't have a base to work from within our own selves. That doesn't mean that Christian education doesn't have a role to play. So I would say Adventist education as part of the wider Christian education definitely has a role to play. I've seen as a teacher, you know, during COVID, obviously a lot of different schools were implementing various forms of mask wearing, no mask wearing, et cetera. We got a lot of kids from other Christian schools transferring into us because their parents preferred our system over the other system. And that allowed me to see all kinds of things, because, you know, I'm getting kids that are coming from the Orthodox church down the road that shut down because they just couldn't hack the the requirements, and so all of their kids all of a sudden come as an influx to the high school. And there's fascinating little things you just kind of learn about, like what kind of Christians are these kids? What kind of background? What do they actually know and not know? You know, and I got to kind of compare and contrast. Here's our little Adventist kids that have been in the system for 8 years, and here's like these different kids coming from a Baptist or an Orthodox background. They know stuff, but then they don't know other stuff. And I'm like, wow, that seems so basic. So it's like, I do feel that the Adventist education, the curriculum at least, though never perfect and irritating in a lot of ways, even now to me as a Bible teacher, definitely still plays a role and is emphasized in a way that I'm not always seeing in other Christian schools when I compare, you know, pedagogy, but also content to content. I do think we emphasize the Bible differently and in a way that does push people to think about it a little bit more critically than sometimes in other places that I've seen.
I smirked for a second when you mentioned the word irritating when describing the Bible curriculum.
You so, teach it too, man.
So
but middle school, right?
I've said it, I think, before on this podcast. Maybe we haven't talked about it at length, and maybe we don't need to dig too deep into it. But
no, you can dig deep. I'm here.
Well, this is my 10th year teaching junior high, right? Grades 6 through 8. And I've done Bible all 10 of those years. I've worn a few different hats alongside Bible, but that's been my main subject. And the core curriculum that we use across the NAD, I don't even know if it's worldwide, Greg, but I know for sure in the NAD, is what it's called Encounter. And and we spoke very briefly with Larry Blackmer, who was one of the driving forces in installing that. It was during
fascinating perspective, honestly.
Yeah,
I appreciated that perspective.
And I didn't mention it with him because it didn't seem to fit.
Yeah.
And to be honest, he had a very positive view of it. And I don't blame him because he was one of the driving forces of it.
Well, and he knew the ethos of it, like what he wanted it to be. It's not necessarily what it is, but it's what he wanted it to be.
Yeah. So Encounter is Encounter is the name of the Bible curriculum that you use K to 12. K to 12 across the North American division. And so it's the main place where teachers that teach Bible in an Adventist school find their lesson plans, or they find their the main standards that they're supposed to teach at. I would say that it would also be where you find assessments, but Encounter really is quite anti-assessment in nature. In fact, at the very start of Encounter, it will tell you that you should never fail a kid in Bible, which I very strongly disagree with.
I have failed many a kid in Bible.
Yes. Yeah, I very strongly disagree.
Enough, I have.
That Bible class is meant to be an academic course.
Yeah,
that's its own debate right there. People talk about, should Bible class just be essentially a spiritual, you know, place to talk to
Sabbath school. Yeah.
You know, Sabbath school essentially versus an academic course, a course alongside math, science, history, language arts, PE. But anyways, Encounter is a mixed bag, I guess I could put it that way. Greg, I don't know, you mentioned the word irritating. I would definitely echo that sentiment, where there's a lot at the heart that I do like about Encounter. And I have taught both. I've taught long enough to have taught the previous curriculum, which was a pile of flaming garbage compared to Encounter. So it was an improvement.
Sure.
It was an improvement, but it still has left a lot to be desired. And so I've had to fill in the gaps. There are good pieces that I can glean from it, but there's also a lot of messy stuff.
Yeah.
And the Encounter curriculum.
Haphazard is how I feel.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of gaps that make me kind of wonder on the national level, what is it that our students, thousands of students, when they come to Bible class, right? What are they experiencing? And there's some things that are good, but there's also ones where when I look through those lesson plans, I'm like, there is no way I can go and do this. Like, this doesn't work. This is either awful. And Anthony, just to clarify, it's not like there's anything theologically like just awful that's not Adventist. It's more that it will come up with different experiences or object lessons that are so bad.
Encounters. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Encounters. And it's meant to be spiritual. It's meant to get to the heart, you know, not just be a knowledge intellectual learning. It's supposed to get to heart learning, soul learning, and create a response to try to elicit a heartfelt response from students. And I like that piece to it. And there are areas it does well, but there's a lot of areas that it just misses the mark in what it's trying to do. So we could probably spend a long time just getting into why that is, but I think mainly, Greg, just kind of circling back to everything, you know, you've taught Bible, you've been in that. Is that what makes an Adventist?
Wait a minute, Sean, before you ask this question, want to know how you got from pastoring to teaching.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like what, when did that happen? Why did that happen? And yeah, what was that transition like?
Me?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, for you, Greg. Yeah.
That transition was interesting. I fell into it, really. I was pastoring, and then my wife got a call, and we'd always, you know, we were both theology majors when we got married. And so I always told her, I was like, look, whoever gets a call first, we follow that. And when it seems like the time is right, then we'll flip when the right call comes for the other person. You know, I was ordained already when I left Washington Conference. She got the call to come down here to NorCal. Good church, great place, good school. It was the right time. So we moved with one job, which is crazy, but we'd only had one job up there too, because I got four kids. We raised our kids up there. We moved with a 6-year-old, 4-year-old, and two 1-year-old twins.
Ugh.
So that was, and then one job.
One job.
One and a quarter jobs. I did do a little quarter time work at the church that they gave me. So other than that, I was mowing lawns. I was just trying to make ends meet. I was doing whatever I could. And then about a year and a half in, the school needed a teacher in two classes, film appreciation and a freshman Bible class. So I filled in for a semester for that. And then the next year, another teacher left that did a lot of the technology. And so all of a sudden they needed computer programming, they needed robotics, they needed photography, which was like my bread and butter from my old days as a nerd. And I kind of fit the bill on multiple fronts. So all of a sudden I was full time. I taught two or three sections of high school Bible. I taught a bunch of the technology courses. So I literally fell into it. It was definitely not a plan, but it was a need.
Right.
So there was never a moment where you're like, I'm done being a pastor. I want to be a teacher now. It was more just
practical.
You know, I had already started my doctoral program when we moved. As a pastor, the last few years, I would definitely say I was veering towards being a teaching pastor because I just liked it more. And I found that really all the problems I was always bumping into were problems of education and understanding and awareness versus simply, like financial. And so I started to realize
sorry to interrupt you. You said the problems you're bumping into, like with people, with church members, theologically.
Okay. I felt like I could best handle them with a teaching role. And that's what I started to make. I just started to do it. You know, I started offering seminars when things would crop up. I'd sit us down and be like, okay, should we have a men and women's foot washing exclusive? That's a discussion. Like, that's something we need to think about. And we're going to have a little seminar on that before we have our board meeting. And I would just take them through, you know, an hour of, here's the background, here's this, here's how the Catholic Church did it, here's why the Pope did the foot washing, yada, 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 here we are. And I started teaching more and more and realized I love it. I love to teach this stuff because I've gone all the way through a master's level in theological education. There's a ton of stuff in that that I never used because pastoring so much was just working with social dynamics and doing business-oriented things and then preaching if you're decent enough during the week. But man, I was so much more filled with what I got in school that I realized if they just could understand the things that we learned, these problems would be fixed. They could. And so I realized I wanted to bring the ivory tower down to the masses because I just felt like so many of the problems I had were understandable, fixable, answerable if you could understand what was out there and what theology and history already had to teach us.
Yeah.
So that's where I think the real passion started.
Greg, I want to jump off of what you just talked about, the heart of what you find life-giving for you in your ministry. And this has been kind of a hot take I've had for a while.
Ooh, which is Sean, that, hot take, I'm ready.
Which is that church should be more like school. That the rhythms of it. I want to see how you feel as someone that's both been in pastoral and education, and specifically the fact that you resonated more deeply with this more classroom-like setting within church in your pastoral ministry, that the rhythm we have set for church, which is essentially to consume, that the default is to church and to consume, that we are setting up our members for failure because all brain science points to the need for us to have a response time, for there to be a rhythm where I hear information and I not only receive it, but I speak it back. I dialogue. I do a Socratic circle. I do a think, pair, share. I do a small group. I do a project to create a call and response system. And Anthony, we've experienced this. And Greg, I'm sure you've heard of the One Project. One Project feel so refreshing a decade or so ago when it started was that they set it up not as pews, but as circles.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
They set up circle discussion tables
where you had a small group leader that after a maybe 15-minute sermon, you'd have questions. It was essentially a classroom.
Yeah.
And that felt refreshing. Again, I could go on forever about this because I've had conversations with so many people about it that I think church would benefit from a restructuring of how the service was ordered and the emphasis on what is meant to happen during a church service.
Yeah.
Greg, what's your take?
I'm curious on your response based on what you just talked about, Greg. Would you be for that in general, or do you have a more nuanced thought based on what you said?
I am for that in a variety of ways. And let me just give you a few of them. If I was to make evangelism educational, I would make our evangelistic technique an educational setting, but I would not make it a fire hose of event that led to a single moment. If you're looking at the typical evangelistic meetings, you're going to get almost 30 different nights, and then hopefully you're going to baptize people at the end of it. They're going to get fire hosed. Are they effectively learning it? No, but they're being effectively convinced and then making a choice. That's not education. That's not growth, not discipleship and understanding. That's simply, I'm bowled over by this and I'm going to just make a knee-jerk choice. I lost most of those people that I put in the tank because they learned new stuff later that they were like, well, that's not what I thought I was getting into. And they were gone.
Yeah.
They could have stuck around. They could have learned. They could have grown into it. If I had taken those meetings and spread them up into like a quarter system, and said, we're going to have this first quarter is going to be talking about these topics. Boom. If you're interested in our church, level one membership in my church to be a participant, to help out in the AV booth, maybe even to be a greeter, is you have to go through that quarter's lessons to become a level one Adventist, right?
Nice.
You're going to get that core level of it, and then you're going to become more and more a member or a leveled up person in the church who can be more and more involved because you're learning the things and you're saying, yeah, I believe that and I accept it. You're dealing with the questions along the way. You're letting this sink in. You're letting the culture become a part of their life rather than saying, here's a month and a half of meetings and now you get to completely upend yourself and throw away all the meat and the jewelry and your friends and maybe your church that you went to for 20 years on Sunday. Throw it all away and now you're with us. And it's like, they you could grow into that and it would be less painful. It would be less problematic for people. Sermons should be educational, if you ask me. Sure, they have to be interesting. They have to be entertaining in a way, but they should also teach. I, at the end of my sermons the last couple of years, I put my cell phone number on the last screen of my PowerPoints, and I said, okay, questions. Actually, I put it at the beginning of the sermon. If you have questions while I'm speaking up here, text it to me, and I'll answer four or five of them at the end. And that way, we can have a dialogue that talks to this, and not just me blathering on for half an hour. Like, education and the scholastic pastor is a thing that used to be. They used to be looked at as doctors in the church because there was an expected educational quality to what they offered the church and the people in the church. We got away from that because, like you said, we became a little bit more consumeristic. We followed certain church styles and methodologies that grew a business church versus an educated discipling church. And that changes. That changes the ethos of the people. It changes their level of education. And it introduces problems that they don't have answers for. They just have a lot of emotions behind. And that, to me, where, man, we could have educated and we could have offered the tools and the things that have for centuries been helping the church, but we kind of pretend like it's not even there anymore.
Yeah. It's a big ship to turn, though, because like you said, I'm actually curious if a lot of people take advantage of that texting component of your sermons, or if you find that many don't.
I like the idea. I've always.
Yeah.
The teenagers would definitely throw in, but I usually got a few other people that have any questions.
Yeah, but I'm sure you would say still that there could even be more components to on top of texting if there were ways to even create voice. So what I love about Sabbath School, because I usually teach about once or twice a month In Sabbath school. And actually, although I have a lot of problems with the Sabbath school quarterly, that, don't talk about Encounter. Let's talk about the Sabbath school quarterly.
Let's not.
John's dropping hot takes like pancakes today.
Is the Sabbath school quarterly being milquetoast?
Hey, Ted?
Actually,
yep.
We
got him.
And edited. That's the reality.
Look, but again, I like the format better than typical church, because it actually has a cultural expectation that I can ask someone else whether it's in the pews or in a small group, you know, room with adult Sabbath school, wherever the setting is, there is an expectation that people will either help read the Bible, will answer some of the discussion questions. That is, when I see that, I'm like, I actually want that to be part of church too. I wish the format was that, whether it's at the beginning, end, or maybe even somewhere in the middle, a time to recalibrate and detox, right? Spiritually detox and respond to what I've been listening to, and have a back and forth. I wish there was more of that by design and a cultural expectation there, because it's one thing to have that there, but if people aren't going to do it, right? They're just uncomfortable.
Right.
The barriers up because of what they expect church to be. It takes time to recreate a culture where that works. Well, that's a challenge right there, is changing that ship.
It's almost like it's a competing value. We want to grow our churches and make them bigger. And that instantly means that those kind of elements in the church service are going to become awkward and not doable. Because in a big group, people are not going to talk openly and freely like that. That's a small group scenario, right? That's a middle to small church that can effectively break into a group thing at the end of the sermon and be like, hey, let's talk about the sermon. You know, like in a bigger session, that's going to be hard. But that's where we're pushing growth and models and evangelism and all these other things. So it is Sabbath school is a perfectly good example of what could be a fantastic element of church, but is less and less used. So many people aren't even coming to school anymore.
Right, right.
Yeah. I gotta tell you, my wife just gave me the 2 minutes. You got kids here. You got to get back out there.
Wow.
I don't feel like I'm done. Good. I know you guys maybe you do feel like we're done, but I'd love to keep the conversation going. I just know that she's like, hey.
No, you're good, man. I wonder, like, your heart in when we originally talked about having you on, your heart about talking about the divide between the two, it really spoke to us. And so I wonder if you had to maybe diagnose the problem and then offer your heart for what you think would bring the two together, what you think would be the glue.
Teacher,
or maybe there shouldn't be
education, church kind of thing.
Yeah, educators and pastors.
Yeah,
The church and the school. What do you think?
If I had to boil it down, I think the heart of the problem comes twofold. You've got more teachers in a conference than you have pastors. So anything that you give to pastors is going to be harder to give to teachers just because of numbers, right? You know, you give out a bonus, $50 to the pastor during COVID, no teachers get something. Well, it's because there's 700 teachers and there's 200 pastors, you know, whatever. That's hard. And just from an administrative standpoint, there's a divide there that people notice and they take offense. It doesn't feel nice. That's going to be one element of the dissension between the two. Another one is education, administrators and pastors work together on committees a lot. They're on church boards, they're on school boards, they're on finance committees, they're on personnel committees. They're going to see sides of each other they don't like, and that's going to kind of sour them towards each other's institution or their area, right? You have enough experiences with a bad teacher or a bad principal, and the pastor's going to be like, I hate doing these school boards, he never comes. And that's just going to engender more dissatisfaction, more resentment towards one side or the other. That to me is where some of this happens. There's discrepancy in how they're treated, but there's also discrepancies in attitudes and the feeling of how you run things. A principal is not a pastor. And frankly, pastors aren't always good administrators, and principals have to be more. Not to say that, you know, they can't be, but a lot of them just, that's not their gift. They're pastoral. They're not administrative like a principal maybe. So it's a mixing of worlds that is a hard, hard mix. And I think that engenders a lot of misunderstanding and dissatisfaction between the two. What could fix, and honestly, I would say that a fixing is always hard. And I would want to see something along the lines of pastors and school administrators, vice principals could be treated at least on the same level. Giving those that kind of balance between the two administrative roles in each group, and giving those equal status, equal opportunity, equal connection and points of connection could at least heal some of the administrative rifts that crop up over time. the difference between teachers is going to be a little harder and pastors, because I think the roles are very different. And I don't think that either side understands each other very well, what they do on a daily basis or how it impacts them on a weekend basis. You're working with teachers who work hard all week and they don't want to come to church half the time. And then you got pastors who kind of make up their schedule all week and then work hard on the weekend. And it's like each person's program needs the people at the time they need them, but both of them are tired when that comes up. Mixing teachers and pastors, man, that's tough, because I don't honestly think they're playing the same role. Yeah. And elders and teachers perhaps could be a little bit more understanding of each other, honestly. Because I think they're working in that scenario a little bit more. I think principals and pastors and vice principals have more in common with each other, but that doesn't mean that's how they all interact.
Yeah. So, and Greg, you spoke to how, like, pastors, if you worked out the hours that you actually got paid, like how much you were getting paid, it's the same thing with teachers, right? So you spoke to something that we've talked about. I think we talked to Larry about this, is we all want to be part of our programs, but it's we're burnt out. We're already tired. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Pastors and teachers have high burnout rates.
I'm
they
super
have
tired.
Times where they're depleted. And you've been in both camps, so you know exactly what that feels like on both sides.
Yeah.
The tired from both. And so that is a challenge, is how do we balance that? How do we empathize with the other side and realize that we're all trying to do ministry, we're all trying to figure out what is Avenue's mission in 2024 and 2025. And how do we do that tangibly? But Greg, I appreciate your perspective. You've talked
Thank you so much, Greg.
Like we need to talk more for sure.
Yeah.
There's so many different subjects and things that we can talk
about.
I
didn't even get into the college side of things, which I'd love to.
Yeah. That's
teaching on Adventist has been a fascinating part of my ministry. So
Sure. But for those that are listening, I encourage you to listen to Avenue's Pilgrimage that Greg and Michael Campbell from Southwestern. He's still at Southwestern, right?
No, he's director of the NAD Archives.
Oh man, so he jumped up, so he's beyond just the collegiate level too. So Michael Campbell and Greg, they both run Avenue's Pilgrimage. It's a great podcast. You should check out. It's all part of the Avenue's History Project, which we've been friends with Matthew for a long time now. If you've been listening to us for the past few years, we've had some good conversations there. But it's great to have you on, Greg. It's good
Thanks
to catch
for having
up.
Me, guys.
And
really good.
Yeah, we're excited to hear from you in the future. You know, just how things are going. We've got a lot. We're recording this a few days before, just to date us, honestly, we're recording this a few days before New Year's, you know, as 2025 looms, and we're getting into a lot of stuff for Adventism that I'm curious to see what's going to be in the future. we've got a GC session coming up and a lot, you know, of conversation happening in Adventism. So, Greg, if I just give you a final word, I know your wife is waiting on you with the kids.
I hear some of my kiddos actually leaving. So I want to say, guys, we're out of here.
So I'll just say, like, as a last word, is there something you're optimistic about when it comes to the future of Adventism, Adventist education? Like, what is it that you're looking forward to?
I am optimistic about, the students. The students, are wrestling with deep problems and deeper issues, and they're looking for deeper answers. If we can meet them at that place, we have a good future ahead of us, because I think these kids want to know and they want to learn and they actually have questions that matter. And we just got to figure out how to meet them there. So I think that's our mission and goal. But should we choose to accept?
Awesome.
Well said.
Greg, thank you so much. We'll have to have you back soon. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks guys.
Thanks, Greg.
Sorry, I had to bail fast.
Hey friends. You've just been listening to another episode of Seeking What They Sought. I'm one of your hosts, Anthony Leiter, and on behalf of all the guys, we just want to say a big thank you to all of you who have come alongside us in our journey to have honest conversations about Adventism. We appreciate each one of you. As usual, if you haven't already, give us a follow on Instagram. It is kind of like our home base, social media-wise, and if you'd like to stay up to date on the episodes that we're posting or just different things that we're doing, you can follow us there. We're also kind of like low-key a meme account, and we post silly videos and other stuff, so give us a follow. We would love it. Also want to say a big thank you to our patrons, and we're really grateful to each one of you for helping us make quality content. So to each one of you, a big thank you, and if you'd like to follow us on Patreon, you can. There's a link in our Instagram bio if you'd like to support us. Thank you so much. Last but not least, if you could you leave us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen, because it really helps us actually in the algorithm to help new people get their eyes on the podcast. So if you could just go in, give us a little, hopefully a 5-star review. But, you know, be honest, that really helps us just in the algorithm, the way that, you know, these things work these days. So we really, really appreciate it. All right. I think that's it for now, friends. So we will see you next time on Seeking What They Sought.